Hello, everybody. Welcome back to A Few Minutes of History. I'm your host, Jake, and today I'm joined by a very special guest. I'm joined by James Jeffries. James, how are you doing?
I'm doing good. Yeah, really excited to be on here and have a good discussion.
Yeah, though, it's something that we set up a while ago, James. I think I can say this with all my guests. I set something up a while ago and it takes ages to sort of actually get going, mainly due to myself because I have quite a busy work schedule. But no, we're going to be talking today about sort of a continuation of my last couple of episodes on the RAF Bomber Command. We're going to be talking Bomber Command, but with the US involvement as well in you know, Europe, which I think is an interesting topic. And I feel like you either get one perspective or the other. You don't tend to get both, which I thought was why it'd be good to do a sort of a joint episode. And you were ever so kind to lend your knowledge on the subject. So thank you. Thank you very much for that.
Oh, absolutely, my pleasure. I think that's a key point actually you raise here is a lot of people do see it as one or the other, and they pick a side saying, "Oh, the US did it better, or the RAF did it," and it's a combined bomber offensive. You know that they did talk to each other. There were grand strategies to this process. You know, so yeah, good point. Good point raised.
No, that is a good point because like you said, you know, everyone. It's one or the other. If they weren't talking to each other, it would have been an absolute disaster. which obviously why they do talk to each other. But James, we'll start with the RAF and we'll start pre the American involvement in the war. So obviously, right from the beginning, the RAF are bombing Germany and German, you know, industrial and units and things like that. How effective is their strategy at the beginning of the war? Are they, you know, operating at their full strength? Are they doing things correctly, you know, as doctrine wise, or is it just a case of let's just go and bomb Germany and try to cause some havoc while the war's ongoing?
Yeah, well, the RAF from the off, I think less than an hour, the first op is carried out, which is looking at shipping Bristol Blenheim on a reconnaissance mission. And really, there is this policy. I mean, in the interwar years, there is this belief of, you know, the bomber will always get through. You get Baldwin saying, I think 32 or something. And there are these air theorists that think, and, you know, they reflect on the First World War. They think, okay, the next war is going to be really quick. It's going to be bombers just flying over, destroying everything, and nothing's going to function. And this is the fundamental sort of belief. But going into the war, there is caution by the RAF. They make sure to mainly stick to bombing ports and shipping to the point that actually they drop their bombs. They fly over the coast into land, turn their bombers back round to make sure that the bombs don't risk missing and hitting residential areas. So there is this conscious, and the other missions you get are the longer range missions at the early part of the war are leaflet dropping, known as nickel raids, basically dropping leaflets going, we think it's a bad idea that we're at war, rethink it, basically. And yeah, I mean, the early period of the war is something that I find particularly interesting because very often it's a case of, oh, Bomber Command were useless pre-Harris coming in. And so I think that's been really dismissive. Yeah, there were major criticisms. And you have the Butt Report, a report especially commissioned to see the accuracy of Bomber Command, which comes up with some horrific statistics. And that's often quite cherry-picked by historians and quite misinterpreted is my idea that they'll pick certain stats from it. And it's taken at a time when there's an industrial haze over the Ruhr area, which they say is particularly inaccurate. And there's criticism at the time by people like Portal or GVS staff saying, come on, this isn't really a good report. You've got photographs here. You know, there's a few here. They might be the same bomber, but you're counting them as separate bombers and raids and such. So there's all these like nitpicking things to take into consideration. And my MA dissertation was looking at Bomber Command in the Battle of Britain, which again, it was James Holland's book, which came out in 2010, I think it was. I bought it, read it. And one of the things I was amazed reading it was, hang on a minute, British bombers were attacking Luftwaffe airfields during the Battle of Britain. I didn't know about that. I knew about, you know, the barges and such. Like, I mean, actually, yeah, this is quite a two-way battle. And I started looking at how the bombers were viewed at the time. And it is about the RAF. It's not just about fighter command. Things like that. You had the Roll of Honour in 1943, which included bomber and coastal command air crews. And, you know, it's something that you just don't see now. It's always fighter command casualties and rolls of honour and the memorials and such like. And I'm there going, hang on a minute, we need to rethink this.
No, that's a good point because a lot of people during, you know, they think the Battle of Britain, you know, they think fighter command, but a key area that a lot of people don't think about, like you just mentioned, is bomber command. You know, hitting those German airfields and harassing them as well. Because, you know, if that didn't happen, even more German fighters and bombers would be able to come over and hit the RAF, the fighter command. Yeah. So they do play a massive, you know, key part of the battle, but they never get spoken about. It's a really good point there.
And the raids on the airfields, they start in June and go on into early September, which is much longer than the Luftwaffe. You know, if you just had that stat in front of you and went, oh, so the Luftwaffe bombed, you know, part of August, little bit into September, and you think, who's the attacker here? You know, it's quite an interesting thing. And they were more nuisance raids, and I think a couple of airfields were put out of action for brief periods, but the morale factor as well. I was finding accounts by Luftwaffe personnel that are just like, we're never going to win this. We can't even control the skies over airfields, let alone how are we going to do it over England, you know, southern England for an invasion. That's the thing with early Bomber Command. We do have this memory of it being Lancasters and the Dam Busters and Harris and such like. It's like there's a whole story before that, and there's a whole learning curve as well, developing tech, developing tactics, which I think needs to be told a little bit more. It's a long way from dropping leaflets to, you know, the raids on Hamburg and Dresden and such like that we have in the popular memory or the collective memory. And I think that needs to be understood. If you jump in at the deep end and look at the heavier raids, you know, it's
No, I do. I feel like it's a great point. And I actually feel like the sort of the war before, especially the British war before sort of 42, is really overlooked, because for the majority of it, you know, it doesn't make great reading, because, you know, we're constantly being harassed and threat of invasion and thrown out of France and Holland, and, you know, it's just a disaster after disaster after disaster, and Rommel comes in and gives us a bit of a kick in Africa, you know. The first couple of years of the war, you know, a lot of people sort of put that out of their mind, I think, a little bit, and go, didn't really happen, because we won anyway, so why do we need to talk about, you know, the bad things? But we do, because that's how we understand how we get to the stages that we, you know, we got to later on.
And that's the other thing that there's mentioned is when it comes to the air war pre-42, it's just the Battle of Britain that's discussed. You know, there's not a lot really about like the rhubarb and raids over France, because, you know, a lot of these fighter pilots that fought in the Battle of Britain are shot down and killed on these raids that really don't achieve much. So we are very selective and go, we'll just forget about that. We'll just focus on the few and then we can jump forward to the, you know. And that's very telling, I think. And it's those sort of stories I want to tell. So when I've given talks, they've been usually about something a bit different. I've generally avoided the Dam Busters, for example, because it's been done, although I am doing something in the summer. I want to talk about raids on Augsburg or Eindhoven, all these kind of lesser known ones. It's like, oh, I didn't know they did that, you know. And there is this false sort of idea that after the early raids in 1939, all bombers, you know, for the RAF bombed at night, and that was pretty much it. Well, it really wasn't. The Blenheims are attacking Luftwaffe airfields in daylight. And, you know, the light bombers into 41, 42. And you've got raids that go all the way to Cologne with these Blenheim bombers during daylight hours. And you do get the heavies involved in daylight raids as well. I mean, Augsburg is one example, but there's plenty of others as well. Okay, it's not the norm, but there is this attempt.
It still happens.
There's constantly trying out new tactics, trying out new methods. It isn't a sort of right, we're going by night because we're safer then, and that's what we're. No, there is attempts to try different things.
No, again, you hit the nail on the head. It's something that is overlooked, but it's great that you're, you know, doing things where you're trying to raise awareness, or not raise awareness, but sort of bring it back into the forefront of people's minds and show people a different perspective. And I think that works really well. James, we will jump forward a little bit to obviously December 1941. America is bombed by the Japanese and brought into the war. Obviously, Germany and Italy then declare war on America, on themselves, on America, and vice versa. So obviously, America's now in the war. How quickly do you think the British are on the Americans? Send your plane, send your crews. Let's sort of do this together. Is it instantly, or is it take a little bit of time for them to sort of?
Straight away is a consideration of wow, this bomber offensive can really step up. And I think you look like the Flying Fortress. The Americans have developed heavy bombers. You've got the Liberator as well. You've got the Norden bomb sight as well. There's a lot of promise here. Obviously, it takes time to develop, and you've got in 42 a lot of these bombers going to the Mediterranean. because the demands of torch and such like, and then even into 43 there's drained resources. So it's only really the summer of 43 they really get going. There are raids, but these are the ones that are going deeper and deeper into Germany. There is a completely different method. I mean, the Americans have had people like Mitchell and such like that have this faith in the bomber, especially in the B-17, that they can defend themselves to the point that you get the specially adapted B-17s that have got extra guns and cannons that don't carry bombs. I can't remember the YB-40s or whatever they're called. You know, that the bombers can absolutely defend themselves. And this just isn't true. As soon as they're without fighter escort, then, you know, you look at Regensburg and Schweinfurt, and there are other examples. They're just absolutely at the mercy. Again, they're trying out different tactics, but you need a long-range fighter protection, you know.
Well, this is it. You know, the Americans come into the war, and they have all these sort of these great ideas, and, you know, they put it into theory. The theory sounds great, like you said, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Bombers being self-sufficient in this sort of, you know, overlapping protection zone where they're all protect each other. That's great in theory, but in practice it doesn't work because the fighters can still get in there and cause havoc, which they absolutely do. And, you know, when you compare it to, say, the British, who have perhaps been doing this for a long time and know that potentially, you know, the daylight raids long range into Germany without fighter escort doesn't work because we've put it into practice, is it you know, it sort of feels a bit like Americans sort of saying, oh, no, we'll be fine. We've got our own. We've got better stuff than you. We can do it by ourselves. Yep. And obviously they do take huge losses initially, don't they? Especially in sort of 42, 43, they take massive, massive casualties.
Yeah. And on the flip side of that, absolutely. On the flip side of that, 43, you look at the summer, you've got obviously Chastise, the dams raid. You've got the firebombing of Hamburg. You've got the Battle of the Ruhr. The RAF are absolutely bossing it when it's coming to bombing.
Yeah.
That absolutely flips when it comes to the Battle of Berlin. And at that point, you know, the Germans have upped their game with defensive capabilities at night and such like, new tactics and Schrager music and everything. Meanwhile, the Americans get the Mustang. They're starting to do the long range, and it's totally flipped, you know, over the course of a matter of months and changes of tactics. It's totally flipped. And I mean, you have the Nuremberg raid, 30th of March, 1944, you know, where, you know, 95 aircraft absolutely blasted out the sky at night. Granted, that was a mixture of bad tactics, bad luck, the weather playing on it as well. But that's the equivalent of the shrine for Regensburg for the RAF, definitely the Nuremberg. But then, yeah, you have Operation Argument, Big Week. And over the course of this period, 42, 43, more and more of the Luftwaffe's resources are on Germany. There's this demand to be seen and this demand to protect. And it makes sense, you know, initially when you've got the P-47s turning back, they can't quite go all the way in the middle of 43. Obviously, the drop tanks develop and then you get the P-51. This means, bring the fighters, rather than having them on the French coast, let's bring them ever further back into Germany. You've got more chance to shoot down the bombers. And of course, that absolutely plays into the plans for Overlord, because it's drawing the Luftwaffe.
Draws them away.
This is the thing that you take into consideration is a lot of people think about the air campaign over Normandy, and it's fair enough. You know, there is a certain degree of bombing beaches and destroying communication lines and such like. But actually, this goes way back. This is a big plan that the British and Americans, all of the Allies have been working towards. And it's taken a long time to do, you know.
Well, that's it. You know, another good point there. You know, people, you know, talk about the lack of the Luftwaffe, you know, around June 1944 and D-Day and things. And that is, like you said, you know, massively down to the RAF and the Americans harassing Germany and bombing Germany, dragging those resources away to put them into Germany because, you know, your capital city's being absolutely hammered night and day. Yeah. You have to defend it. Otherwise, you know, morale just will tank. So to take those resources away from the front line, it causes massive, massive problems for the Germans because obviously, as we see, the Allies have absolute air superiority on D-Day. And
Incredible. Yeah, the stats are just mind-boggling. But as I say, this isn't something that's happened overnight. This has been
It's all a plan in motion, isn't it? It's all part of the same sort of tree.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, that's the thing that I always kind of wonder is if Bomber Command hadn't gone back to, you know, their strategy of bombing cities and such like. After Overlord, so the end of 44 into 45, I wonder if the memory would be, wow, look at what they did for Overlord. You know, that, yeah, that could be the finest hour, to use that quote that's so often used. and it does raise some questions. And the other thing is, like we mentioned at the start, you do get this comparison. And I watched a very, very interesting video that said, you know, the heroic, brave Americans attacking in day against all the odds and pinpoint targets, the British very cowardly at night. You know, it's just indiscriminate bombing. And it's like, that's simplifying it a lot.
That's a very simple mindset to have, isn't it? That's
And it, as I say, it's just not the case, and they are working together, and you do get this concept of bombing around the clock. And the sharing of tech is a big thing as well. So you've got things, you know, G and H2S and such like, and that they're shared, you know, they and actually it becomes H2X, which the Americans use really effectively over Japan, because there's lots of coastlines, and it really works for them. And they're attacking, you know, high level through clouds and such like, they need this tech. And of course, that's come by one way of Brit development, you know. So I think that's, but it, again, it goes both ways, you know.
No, I completely agree. You know, at the end of the day, you're an allied force. You need to sort of combine your resources and pull them together. If you don't do that, then you're never fully gonna be compatible and be working as one unit, which effectively it's what they're trying to do, isn't it? I know it's you know, the US and the RAF are completely different entities, but they have the same objective, and the objective is to beat the Germans. The quickest way to do that, share your resources, share your technology, combine it, and you can go as one. That's something that the Allies do very well together, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's, for me, the key lesson actually of why the war was won, was because, you know, ultimately it was collaboration between numerous countries.
Yeah,
you know, it's and it goes way back. I mean, without getting to sort of my beer my bonnet, it's the alone myth of Britain in 1940. It's like, oh, come on, you know, you got the Empire, the Commonwealth, you got the three forces, and you got resources from outside, the trade that's going on, the access to shipping that's available and such like, is just totally not alone.
That's certainly is a one of those myths that I think these days you sort of, it's been quashed completely, but it's still brought up, because like you said, you know, we weren't alone. We had the biggest we still had the largest empire. You know, ultimately, and you know, the Americans were supplying us, and like you said, you know, the free forces, the Poles, and you know, all those other guys coming over.
Absolutely. I mean, Park Canada plays as well. Wow. The resources, the contribution. That's another thing I always make a point of is, you know, the Canadian contribution to Bomber Command is huge as well. I mean, they've got their own group, six group. And something I always mention.
Yeah, well, that's it. You know, people overlook, you know, the Canadians, they overlook the Poles as well. I think they're another one that are often very overlooked in terms of the, especially. But so the idea of these joint operations then between the British and the Americans, who takes sort of command of that? Is it the RAF, because, you know, it's Europe, and obviously Britain being in Europe is the idea that they'll take command, or is it an American-led sort of operation? How does it work command-wise? Who sort of makes the overarching decisions?
I mean, you have the main thing is the directives that are put forward. So you have things like, you know, the Casablanca, for example, that basically talks about the overall strategy of all Allied forces. So it'll come up with, okay, we're going to do a landing. It's going to be Operation Torch and knock the Axis forces out of Africa. That's going to be off. It's going to be, let's land in Italy and draw forces away. It's going to be, let's land on the coast of Normandy, et cetera, et cetera. And with that, there are plans for the Air Force to do that as well. And there'll be discussions. There'll be joint discussions with the RAF, United States Army Air Force as well. So you'll have the chiefs of staffs making decisions. And then it's up to really the commanders of the forces. So for the RAF, it would be Harris. Mm-hmm. How are you going to do this? So the memorandum could be to target the German Luftwaffe. Now it's up to him to decide really the most effective way. But there are suggestions. You know, you do get Chief of the Air Staff Portal. There will be discussions with Prime Minister Churchill, etc. But as I say, also these joint discussions with the United States Army Air Force. So I've kind of probably complicated it quite a lot. There's a lot of people.
Lots of moving parts.
Yeah, and that's the other thing is, you know, we talk about, so for example, the raids on Hamburg in July of 43, the Americans bombed as well. It's yeah. tend to thought of as an RAF operation. It's like, no, you know, the United States Army Air Force were there as well. Same goes with a lot of operations and things like Big Week as well, Operation Argument, which essentially knocks the Luftwaffe out of the sky. Well, the night raids that Bomber Command were taking part in over that period were backing that up as well. But again, it's kind of thought as a, or remembered more as an American operation because, you know, it was the Mustangs that were shooting down the German aircraft, and it just kind of fits into a more, I don't know, exciting narrative, I guess. I don't know if that's really the word, but it's, yeah, that's the thing to consider is it is joint throughout, you know.
Yeah, there is a lot of, I think there's still a lot of sort of thoughts these days that it is one or the other, isn't it? There's yeah. no, or oh, you know, they were one on, it was one or the other. what does Harris think of the Americans when they come over? Because he's an interesting character, to say the least. And I always get the impression that he would not be impressed by, you know, these American flyboys, to put it lightly.
I think Harris, I mean, just as an aside, I find an absolutely fascinating figure.
Yeah, definitely.
I think there's a lot of misunderstanding. There's a lot that's been misread about him. He also doesn't help himself with some of his phrases, some of his attitudes, et cetera, et cetera. My fundamental thing is, you know, oh, great, we can really double the strategic bombing campaign now, really up yeah. it, use the Americans. I think he thinks, you know, they're bonkers for going in daylight, and he says, look at what happened with us. And the Americans are like, no, we got the Flying Fortress, 50 cows on them, and, you know, they'll be fine. And there is kind of, as I say, this period, end of 42 into 43, where the British do look like they're bossing it. But it is a case of developing that long-range fighter in the day, persevering and working out a strategy to work together. I think he thinks, oh, the Americans will switch tonight at any time. They can't sustain these sort of losses, which, of course, they don't, and they're not built for that. I don't think there's any sort of, you know, much eye rolling by Harris. I think that other than the fact of, like, why don't you bomb Berlin with, he's got this absolute obsession in the 43 into 44 about just pulverizing Berlin, and that will be...
He's obsessed with hammering Berlin to pieces, isn't he?
Yeah, and it's a ridiculous strategy. I mean, we can say that with hindsight now, but, you know, Berlin isn't a more modern city. It's not made up of, you look at places like Lübeck or even Hamburg, actually, you know, with the older cities that will cause these sort of, it's not going to happen at Berlin. No. It's so far to travel to as well. You've got really a limited time to do a campaign over the winter. I think it's about eight, 9 hour flight. So you need 8-9 hours of darkness, which narrows it down. It's just, I think it does start getting personal. And again, he does really want the Americans to join him. And there are Americans that are keen to target Berlin to say that they've done it. But the main strategy is, let's knock the Luftwaffe out. That's, you know.
Well, ultimately, that's what's going to win you the war, isn't it? Destroying the enemy rather than burning his cities. Because as the Germans, you know, prove, you can hammer them to pieces in their cities and where they live. But they will ultimately carry on because of their loyalty to what they believe is, you know, the correct way of thinking. And I think you can argue, you know, the Americans are correct. You know, if we destroy the Luftwaffe, you know, it's game over for them. Yeah. And then we can, you know, target, you know, factories and bits and bobs like that. Yeah. And it makes it ultimately easier, doesn't it? But like you said, I think Harris sort of gets in the mindset of just sort of blind revenge, I guess, a little bit. I always get the impression reading about Harris that his eyes always sort of looking at Berlin going, we'll be back, like, you know. Yeah. I will hammer you again.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, I think it's when he's working the air staff in London that he comes up with the "they've sown the wind, we're going to and they'll reap the whirlwind." So that's right back from the Blitz, really, on London, and obviously many other cities and towns were bombed. But him actually seeing it, I think that really got his back up. And there is still this thing in throughout the war. And even when it's, you know, almost game over, he's there going, no, we've got to keep hammering Berlin. And it's, okay. And that's the other thing is, I mean, when the Americans and the RAF do join as well, when they target oil near the end of the war. That's very successful. I mean, there are other factors to consider about the defences not being what they used to be over the Reich and such like, but that was a solid plan as well. But yeah.
Well, no, exactly that. Another side question for you is, well, obviously we see raids like the dam busters and technology like that sort of being introduced by the RAF. Do the Americans have any sort of zany, wacky ideas that they want to bring to the table? Or is it sort of at that point they, you know, it is just, let's just sort of end the war as quickly as possible?
Yeah, I don't think so. Or certainly nothing that compares to, like, you know, the upkeep bouncing bomb, as it's known. I don't think there is anything really as wacky to that level. I mean, yeah, and Harris shows reservation about the dams raid, and actually I'm probably going to get flack for this. No, sorry, pun not intended there, that was a terrible use of I can see why he's got reservations. There is this untried technology, it's low level in moonlight, so yeah, the Lancasters aren't really going to be able to be hidden, taking crews away from, you know, that could be deployed on tours. What are you gonna, you know? And he's had the experience of these low-level raids and these daring raids. And actually, you look at the stats for the losses on that raid, they're very heavy.
Yeah.
For what it is, it's not something sustainable that's going to be done a lot. It is a one-off, which it ultimately is at the end of the day. So I can see totally where his reservation is coming from. And actually, my sort of interpretation is there are a lot of these raids, and I draw a comparison to Augsburg, low level, deep into Germany, Lancaster's five group, VC. The only thing it doesn't have is a bouncing bomb. Otherwise, you know, it's very, very similar in terms of what happens and the heavy losses and such like. So it's not by means unusual. I think the unusual aspect, and at the time, these raids, you know, they're all over the newsreels and the press and such like. But there is this narrative since that's put the damn busters into its own category, perhaps because it's got a wacky bomb. And
it's something a bit different, well, I guess, isn't it? Yeah.
And the fact that it's got that film, which there are other films, and I mean, this is part of what I'm studying at the moment, is looking, the chapter I'm working on for my thesis is looking at TV and film and how representation has changed. Yeah, the Dam Busters is the Bomber Command film, which is strange because it was so, so unusual, but it makes so much of it, you know. And it just adds kind of to the legacy and such like.
No, that's really interesting. Like you said, it gets so much publicity and so much praise, but, you know, while they did succeed, they do take massive casualties, ultimately the Germans recover from it very, very quickly.
I really don't think it does much. You know, it's there's the initial fear, there's the initial worry, but you have that with other raids as well.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree. I think every time I've seen, you know, people like us who sort of speak out a little bit against the Dam Busters and things, who sort of not criticize it, but say, ultimately, what did it do? Mm. Everyone sort of jumps on you. Oh, you know, it was great, and it was a great film. You know, and it's like, yeah, it was, but, you know,
yeah.
Ultimately, the Germans recovered from it very quickly, and that was sort of the end of it. And we didn't do it again. So,
absolutely. And the main thing I want to do is, and I had a good friend say this to me: other squadrons are available. I want to talk about those other squadrons. I want to talk about those other raids. You know, there's a whole story here, rather than just focusing on 617 squadron.
Well, that's it. It has almost been done to death a little bit now as well. I think, you know, because it is so famous, and it is, you know, they do have that. You said they have that film, and they have, you know, it's the mystique, and it's technology that's exciting and new at the time, and it does it is a fantastic story, and it is very cool. There is other people other people doing other cool stuff.
Absolutely. And it was when I was researching my MA about the Battle of Britain, there was a raid on the Dortmund Ems Canal, which was transporting invasion barges from Germany to the Channel ports. Again, it's low level, it's over water, they have a specially adapted bomb mine that they drop. And it's the last aircraft out of this flight. Five group again, low level, you know. And there's a VC for this last aircraft that actually managed to destroy it. I think it's nearly 2 weeks, the barges are held up right in the middle of the Battle of Britain, right in the middle of, I mean, you can have that discussion about whether there was going to be an invasion, but it was very real at the time. The threat and, you know, there is this effort being put in. So you've got to take it seriously. Yet that raid is just kind of forgotten about. And I'm thinking, there's so many things that tick boxes, you know, that are...
The excitement factor.
Yeah. And actually Gibson, who obviously led the dams raid, almost went on the Dorton Ems Canal raid.
Wow.
So he was flying Hamblers at the time. He almost went on it. So, yeah. Another link.
He ultimately could have took part in two very exciting.
Yeah.
No, that's really interesting. Like you said, you know, I think it's great what you're doing with trying to bring to light these other sort of stories, because they are so fascinating. That one, you know, I didn't know that one you just mentioned there, and it sounds, you know, it's fascinating. Little tidbits like that.
Yeah, and like I say, for researching it from my MA, I learned so much. The effort in the Battle of Britain, considering how small Bomber Command was compared to what it was later, is absolutely astronomical. And it's like, we need to talk about this. You know, this is contributing to the RAF. You know, in the Battle of Britain, that's how it should be discussed. And Coastal Command, I will hold my hand up and say Coastal Command too. Before someone
No, 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 absolutely. So. A quick one is you know, the losses that we obviously see from, you know, the allies, I guess, in Bomber Command. They take massive losses, both of you know, the Americans and the British, don't they? Is there ever a point during the raids where either, you know, the Americans or the British sort of look at their losses and the number of aircraft they're losing as well, and think, you know, maybe we need to sort of to rein this in a little bit, because it is getting a bit much? Or is it a case of, you know, we have to keep hammering them and eventually they will fall? Is it like that? Or, you know, do we I know Harris gets a bit of a bad rap, but, you know, I can't imagine that he saw the losses that his men were taking and was sort of taking any enjoyment out of it.
No. And he really, really did care about the air crews. It would have got to him. He would have put on a strong face. But he was always... Like I say, the one thing is the Battle of Berlin, as he calls it. That's the other thing, is he always says the crews are going into battle, they're not operations. So it's the Battle of Hamburg, it's the Battle of the Ruhr, it's the Battle of Berlin. To try and get this mentality, and he will give orders of the day, you know, here's a chance to burn the heart of the enemy and all this sort of stuff that he says, absolutely stirring. But yeah, when it comes to losses, I think the British and the Americans, they take from them, they learn from them. They, you know, so the initial losses in 1939, where you get 50% losses on raids in daylight on the ports and such like, they go, okay, we can't do that anymore. We're going to change it. Same goes Berlin, you know, after the Nuremberg raid, they go, okay, yeah, we can't do that anymore. That's not the directive. And there had been discussions, there had been heavy losses in raids, and the losses had risen. And as I say, 43, the Americans are going, we're taking a hammering. We need to really, really develop the long range fighters, work on that. And they're trying different tactics all the time as well. You know, I mean, actually, the Schweinfurt Regensburg, there is this delay between the two different formations of B-17s. That if there hadn't been so much fog over England, the decisions have been slightly different, it could have been a different story. So sometimes there are things like the weather that just make that, and they accept that, they go, okay, we need to learn from that, next time we won't do that, you know, one flight flying off to Africa and the other one coming back and to England and such like. So they learn from it, and there's constantly adapting tactics and working out new methods, which I think is credit to the Allies. Trying these new things, bringing in these new technologies, trying these different aircraft and such like. So I'd say, yeah, the losses are felt, but they're acted upon.
Well, that's what I guess always refreshing to hear, isn't it? Because you know, they do try to make things safer for their crews, and they do try to change these tactics, because, you know, ultimately, if they run out of men, they can't continue with their mission. And it is that simple, isn't it? You know, it's manpower and equipment. And ultimately, that will win you the war. And if you're not doing everything you can to keep those two things running, then they will. You will ultimately fail, and the Germans will be able to, the Luftwaffe will be able to keep going and things like that. And it is an interesting one. Another sort of a point is, obviously, the American crews, I think, is it 25 missions, and they sort of get to go home. With the RAF, obviously, there isn't the chance to sort of go home, because they are home, I guess. But do they have a tour of duty, or is it until the war is finished?
No, they have a tour of duty, 25. It changes throughout the war, actually. The number does change. But yeah, they'll do their set tour. They'll have a break. They might go to instructing, training. They might get a desk job. They might go, you know, admin work or something. Particularly famous people. So I've mentioned Guy Gibson again. You know, he goes to America gives talks to recruits in Canada and such like. So there is that. But then they will return after a period. All the idea is to return. But as I say, you know, with these tours, the really, really interesting stat, which makes sense when you think about it, are the most likely time to be shot down during a tour is the first few missions and the last few.
Yeah.
You know, the middle period is actually kind of the safer period. Not to say that it was safe and crews didn't get shot down, but it's interesting because I think it says something about, you know, the first few missions, you're getting used to the crew.
Yeah,
you're getting used to the aircraft, the processes and such like. Might be that little bit more nervous, might make the odd mistake or something. And then I think a similar thing comes when it's, we've nearly done it. You know, we're nearly there, just a few more missions. And you start being that little bit more cautious, maybe that little bit more fatalistic as well, going, we're not going to make it. We've got three left. We're not going to, you know.
Tiredness and things like fatigue like that start to set in as well, don't they? And, you know, especially combat fatigue and, sitting, you know, flying to Germany for 9 hours constantly, having to keep your eyes open in the cold and the wind and looking for enemy fighters. I mean, it must have been absolutely exhausting to do that continuously. Yeah. And like you said, it's interesting though that first period and that last period are your two most dangerous sort of times. And it makes sense though, doesn't it? It does make sense when you think about it.
Yeah, and crews are incredibly superstitious. And it's the same with the Americans as well. You know, they'll have their lucky charms. They'll have their little rituals that they'll do before going on missions, you know. Whatever it might be, you know, say a prayer or you get tail gunners that will urinate next to their...
You know, I've heard stories of that, yeah.
Yeah, you know, there's all these things that seem to happen, which makes sense because it is going into the unknown. And of course, it varies for crews when is the most dangerous time. I mean, the loss rates is you look at, you know, the stats as a whole. So Bomber Command, for example, because I know the figures, 55,000, you know, 120,000 served. You add on POWs, you add on wounded, etc. It's over 50%.
It's a ridiculous number, isn't it? It's a ridiculous figure.
It is. But again, it depends on what period of the war. If you're in a Manchester bomber in the end of 1941 going over the Ruhr, that's not that safe compared to, I don't know, you're a Lancaster on, you know, doing a bombing run daylight in Normandy with fighter escort. Yeah. Or, you know, it really does depend on that. And of course, you don't know what the mission is going to be until you go into that briefing. I mean, crews would have an idea. So you'd see, okay, there's less bombs here and more fuel. It's going to be a long distance. Yeah. Or, you know, there's a lot of bombs here and hardly any fuel. Great. It looks like, you know, France.
Yeah.
So there'll be guesses as well that crews would do and that they'd suss it. But when they went into the briefing room and, you know, the officers at the front would have given the description and the red tape from the base to the target, real gulp moment, you know. And I say the development of technology, I mean, as an aside anyway, the speed that aircraft develop over about, I don't know, 25, 30 years is absolutely incredible, you know, from biplanes to jets.
It is crazy, you know, like you said, you look at the aircraft at the end of the First World War compared to the aircraft at the end of the Second World War. I mean, a few years later, we're going into space, you know, it's things like that. It's mental.
What's the thing? Over a lifetime, you've had the Wright brothers and then you've had Neil Armstrong at the end of it. You're thinking, wow, how is this? And of course, you know, two world wars drive technology to be developed. There is that more investment and money, because that's the other thing to remember, actually, with the strategic bombing campaign, is there is a constant, I can't think of the word, but this technology battle, whether that's at night, whether that's at day, that is constantly happening, you know. So there might be, you might have a system like G that will help with navigation. Well, eventually the Germans work out a way to track G and find it, and then they can find where the bombers are and get an idea of where they're going, et cetera, so there's got to be counterpoints to that. There is constant development, and on the tactical level as well. So I mean, people say to me, you know, Strega music, why was there not a ball turret gunner on a Lancaster? You know, well, there was on some. The B2s had guns underneath, but they didn't catch on to this because it was so successful. You know, they thought, you know, there's one point where they thought it was new developments in flak and such like, because these Lancasters and Halifax was just blowing up out of nowhere, seemingly not being attacked. Yeah. So, that, you know, and once that was discovered, and yeah, it's it does get, I mean, you do have onboard radar eventually that can help. But again, the Germans catch on to this and then go, oh, we can use that to track the bombers. Thanks for that. That's nice and handy, you know.
Well, this is it. You're constantly battling your enemy, which is constantly, you know, playing catch up to you. And every time they catch up, you have to get ahead of them again. And it's constant, isn't it? And
yeah.
That's why, you know, like we said, you know, technology advances so fast during the Second World War.
Yeah.
It's because you constantly, you know, you've got all these minds coming together and really putting their, you know, their brains to the paper and saying, this is what we need to do. This is how we're going to do it. The Germans know this, so we need to do this. And it works. It is. And I say it's that simple because obviously it isn't, but it is, I guess, when you think about it, when you break it down to its simple form.
Oh, yeah. You think navigating at the start of the war in 39 was by the stars.
Yeah.
and you needed moonlight as well to see the ground. You would never fly in moonlight in 1944. That's absolutely asking for trouble. But the German tech there for night fighting was pretty much non-existent at the start of the war. That's had to develop. That's had to change.
Yeah.
And I think there are things to consider when you're looking at a particular period, or as I said earlier, I think you need to look at the whole campaign. And actually, I'd say you probably need to think about the First World War and the interwar years in the terms of theory and development and belief over the bomber. That people go, why are they doing this tactic? Why is it? Because they didn't know. You know, there was so much theory that on paper was, you read it and you go, wow. If you don't know what's going to happen, but once you know what's going to happen, you go, what were they thinking? And it's just, it's the glory of hindsight, isn't it?
Well, this is it. You know, if you don't try it, you don't know if it's going to work or not.
I know
it's a simplistic mindset, especially when you're sort of playing with people's lives and technology and equipment. Yeah. But ultimately, you are at war, and you know people know the risks, and you do have to try things. If you don't try it, you don't know if it's going to work. Yeah. And that is
absolutely. I was just going to say, very quickly, the other thing is you've got to remember with these air cruisers, they're all volunteers.
Exactly that.
You know, they know what they're signing up to. So, yeah.
No, exactly that. James, we put out a Twitter post just sort of asking for questions. And I believe you had a question come through from somebody.
I did, yes. It was, did the RAF also run long-range fighter bomber missions prior to Overlord? So, you mentioned the 8th Air Force running deep fighter bomber missions. Again, that you do have that initially at the start of the 8th Air Force's campaign, but they're usually Spitfires, RAF Spitfires, actually, that are escorting the B-17s. Then you do have the Thunderbolts. The RAF, when it comes to long-range fighters, it isn't really under a consideration. So you get the Rhubarb and Circuses and such-like missions in 41, but the Spitfires and Hurricanes, the thing to remember is there is such a belief over the bomber that it would get through, that the fear is we need fighters to protect, you know, the bomber, they'll be fine, you know. And there is this fear. There's no thought about having a long-range escort, really. I mean, you do have some examples, like I say, the Messerschmitt 110 has that little bit further range, so that can be used. But there's many questions over how good a fighter that was. But anyway, I digress slightly. There isn't this thought. So when it comes to going on the offensive 41, it's like, well, we really need to work on this. And there are discussions. But I think by that point into 42, and when the Americans come in, it's a case of, do we really need it? So there are night intruders and mosquito fighters go in with bombers at night sometimes. But again, it's quite confusing and difficult at night, you know, to get into combat. So the theory is really, well, the Americans have got it going. Let them go with it. They're mainly attacking by daylight. They can do it, you know.
Yeah.
So that's really the mindset. So it's a bit of a yes and no answer, but mostly no.
No, it makes sense though, I guess. And then, like, you know, after Overlord, obviously the air bases in France and stuff, so they can send the escorts with them, which obviously solves two problems. You know, it solves another problem.
Yes. And of course, bombers have, you know, less distance to fly home if they need to. They can
exactly
stop off in France and, yeah, higher survival rates, et cetera, et cetera. There's another question I had a little while ago was, why are the fighters in the south and the bombers in the north when it comes to England for the RAF? And I mean, yeah, you have the US Air Force in East Anglia, not far from where I am. They're absolutely, you look at a map, there's tons of airfields around here. Yeah. Floating aircraft carrier, you know, almost. the island aircraft carrier, I should say. And the simple thing is, you know, they didn't know that France was going to fall. The north is, Lincolnshire is the nearest route to go to Germany. The south is where London is and the infrastructure. That's where you're going to want to protect the docks and such like and ports and your capital. That's why the fighters are there, or the majority of the fighters are there. That kind of answers, I sometimes get asked that, you know.
It makes sense though, doesn't it? You know, and having them all in the same area is obviously you know, you've got logistical things to think of and things like that, where you're going to put an extra, you know, all these bomber crews as well as the fighter crews, I mean, and the Americans and the, you know, it's just other problems.
Yeah, and there's thousands of personnel on an airfield, you know, all the ground staff and officers and clerks and, you know, men and women that were there. Yeah, it's a huge, huge operation. And they often, just to give a nod to the ground crews that would really, really work hard. And, you know, they had a tough war as well, in the sense of not seeing crews come back. It would weigh on their minds. My goodness, did I, you know, did the gun jam? Was it my fault? You know, that would constantly be. And then when you get crews coming back, and you've got stories of remains having to be hosed out by ground crews, you know, a turret gunner that's been killed. And yeah, it's not easy. There's going to be a huge amount of stress, worry, and experiences of loss and tragedy, you know.
Absolutely. I think I actually watched the Memphis Belle the other day, the film, and they do portray the ground crews, you know, watching the planes coming back and them counting them. And you know, that you sort of see this, I know it's a film and they are actors, but you see, you know, the worry of, oh, there's only 12 out of 15 come back, and you know, things that, you know, I think that's a good point as well. You know, it's often overlooked that the ground crews and the support units that effectively keep the bomber crews and the fighters, you know, flying.
Oh, absolutely.
They are often sort of overlooked, because, you know, without them, there is no planes to be flown.
absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, the crews would have a good relationship with the ground crews. That's another thing I really like, and something to be aware of. You know, when it comes to a crew, there's no room really for snobbery. It changes, you know, over the course of the war. You might have a sergeant gunner who shouts corkscrew, skip, you know, make an evasive action to a pilot who's a squadron leader. And that squadron leader does not question it. That guy is in that job because he's the best at that job.
Yeah.
And you trust him. They come from all over the world, all different parts of the country as well. Other things to consider. It's really about teamwork on every level when it comes to this.
Absolutely. I think, you know, we keep saying it, but that's another thing that's sort of overlooked as well, isn't it? You know, the different sort of backgrounds of everyone in this plane. You know, you could have, like you said, you know, squadron leaders and officers, you know, piloting the plane, but if his tail gunner tells him that you know, he needs to take evasive action, he's gonna do it. He's not gonna question him. You know, you're a sergeant, you can't tell me what to do. He's gonna do it regardless, because, like you said,
and same goes with relationship.
They have to trust each other, don't they?
Oh yeah. And there's trust in the ground staff and back, and talking, and flight engineers, you know, asking about engines and knowing absolutely everything. It's and putting faith into it. It's huge, and definitely something to consider when it comes to this.
Absolutely. James, I think we've sort of talked a good deal amount. That's flown by, that, you know, 50 minutes of great conversation. It's been an absolute pleasure having you on, mate. Thank you for coming on, and I'm sure we'll get you back on again at some point, because this has been really good. If people want to get in touch with you or learn about, you know, you do post some good stuff online, like interacting with and things, where can people find you and, you know, get in touch with you if they have questions?
Twitter's probably the main one. All lowercase, James J History. You can find me on there, and I post all sorts, to be honest. It might be it might be linked to my research. So I'm looking at film and television at the moment, and how that's reflected and changed over the years. But I absolutely love hearing from people, and hearing perspectives and thoughts, and please do get in touch.
No, definitely. I'll link James's Twitter in the description of this podcast as well. So if you do want to find out where he is and get in touch with him, you will be able to do that. James, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for coming on today's episode. Thank you, everybody, for listening. We'll see you on the next one. Cheery bye.